So we're looking at the story of Elijah in the Old Testament. The New Testament says that the stories of Israel were written for us as church as both wisdom and warning. So they're not, in one sense, they seem very remote, historical stories, a bit fantastic, what's this to do with us? But we receive them as wisdom and warning. What can we learn from this? What can we be careful about in our lives because of what we read in these stories? And we've got to the bit in the Elijah story where he is sent now to Ahab the king. If you remember, Ahab the king is the source of much evil in Israel. Elijah has been sent to him to tell him that the rain will stop in the land. A physical drought will kind of come as a result of the spiritual droughts which the Israelites themselves had caused, as God's means of calling his people to attention. It wasn't a punishment, it was a kind of a, can you not see what's happening here? I love you and I want you back kind of drought. Now, they may not have received it in that way, but that was the intent behind the drought. And for 3 years, they'd suffered drought. Elijah, if you remember, had been prepared by God, he'd been provided for by God in a range of out-of-the-way places where in different ways his faith was built, incrementally learning to trust God more and more and more for provision, for protection, and for guidance. And eventually, we get to 1 Kings 18, verses 16. It's quite a long passage. I'm going to sort of skim read it a little bit with you this morning. Elijah appears to King Ahab, and Ahab greets him with these words of warmth and welcome. Is that you, you troubler of Israel? And Elisha kind of bounces it straight back to Ahab, and he says, I've not made trouble for Israel, but you and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now, the Baals were the gods that Israel had kind of taken on board alongside God, who I call Yahweh, just for the sake of clarity this morning. Alongside Yahweh, they'd kind of taken on the Baals, the gods of the Canaanites. And they'd also taken on the Asherah goddess, who was a goddess of sexuality and a goddess of fertility. And they'd worshipped these two gods. And the whole episode here is about this clash between the gods that Israel had started to worship and the true God, Yahweh. The story is not really about how much faith could Elijah have. The story is about how much trust would Israel put in the true God. Will they or will they not come back to the God who brought them out of Egypt, the God who'd fed them in the wilderness, the God who'd given them a wonderful land to live in, the God who they seem to have forgotten in favor of these other gods? Will they come back to the true God or not? That's the kind of the point of the story. So Elijah comes up with this plan. Summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Jezebel, Ahab's wife, she'd introduced a lot of these gods into Israel as a result of Ahab's marriage to her, a non-Israelite. She'd brought her gods into Israel, and Israel had become polluted spiritually by that marriage. And so here we find that there are quite a lot of people whose day job is to advocate for Baal and Asherah. 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah. So 850 versus one Elijah, who at this point feels like he's the only one who's standing up for Yahweh, the true God. 850, that's a lot of people to suddenly have in front of you. But notice also around the circle here of this kind of hillside, all of Israel is invited to watch the spectacle. This is going to be a very public display. Unlike the feeding at the brook in God's provision at Kadesh a couple of chapters ago, unlike the miracle in Zarephath, this is going to be a kind of a public demonstration for the people of Israel. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal is God, follow him. So here's the ultimatum. This is what it's all about. This is kind of the crunch time for Israel. Will they respond to the true and living God or not? But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, I'm the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. So Elijah, always through this story, is putting himself at a disadvantage. They choose the bulls, they choose which bull they want. At every point, he sets it up so that they have the advantage and he is disadvantaged in this story. In other words, God, Yahweh, is called upon to operate against incredible odds. Everything seems set against God in this. Can God be God when everything is set against him? Then all the people say, what you say is good. That's a great scheme. What a wonderful idea. We'd never have thought of that. So they rush off, and much to the bull's displeasure, they find two bulls, and they bring them back, and they prepared the bull, we're told, which, you know, sounds quite nice, but if you're a bull, wasn't really that nice. They prepared the bull, and they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. 3 hours. Now, if you think this service is long, you think this talk is long, this was a long time of prayer. This was a prayer meeting such as we don't like to attend. 3 hours of prayer. They called from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. Why? Because there was no one there. But they didn't know that. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. And at noon, Elijah became overwhelmed with the humor of this spectacle. And he began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought. Or busy, or traveling. Maybe he's just sleeping and must be awakened. Actually, one of those Hebrew words in there could be equally well translated. Maybe he's gone to the toilet, relieving himself somewhere. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. So now we've gone to the end of the afternoon. It's a six-hour calling on Baal, but there was no response. No one answered, and no one paid attention. Listen to hear that. No one, no one, no one. There was no one behind this ridiculous belief that if we just serve this thing, life will work better. Then Elijah said to all the people, at the end of it, they were probably exhausted. They were bleeding pretty heavily. I mean, some of them, I don't know, may have been close to death. I've no idea by this point. But Elijah said to all the people, come here to me. So they came to him. Okay, we'll move to this barbecue over here. That one didn't work too well. Let's go and look at this one. So they came to Elijah. And Elijah, what did he do? He repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Now, we understand that when Jezebel came to Israel, one of the things that she got her prophets to do, the prophets of Baal and Asherah, was to destroy the altars that had been built to Yahweh. When Israel divided into two kingdoms, southern kingdom and northern kingdom, they built altars in these different places to remind themselves of the God who was centered in Jerusalem, but who they could worship now in these more remote places. But when Jezebel had become queen and married Ahab, she'd had these altars destroyed. The first thing that Elijah does is he rebuilds the altar. And then what does he do? He took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob. Your name shall be Israel. And with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it, large enough to hold two barrow loads, as it were, of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. So I'm going to make this as hard as I can for God. Okay, you've had 6 hours with dry wood in favorable conditions for your Baal to do his stuff. I'm going to make this hard. And I'll say why in a minute. So he ordered them to fill these jars with water. They poured it over the wood and over the altar, four large jars. He said, do it again. And so they did it again. Do it a third time, he ordered. And they did it a third time. This was a long show, and you can imagine, this wasn't just like, because remember, we're in a drought here, so they probably had to go quite some way to find enough water to keep lugging up. They must have been quite disappointed when he said, do it again. So, well, okay. But they were willing to do it. So all that time, Israel was thinking, this is impossible now. Our God could never do this. He's made it impossible for God to be God. Okay, Baal didn't seem to do much, but how could God act now in these impossible situations? The water ran down the altar and even filled the trench. And at the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, the Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. This is what it's all about. This is the very epicenter of the story. Elijah's deep faith, standing alone in front of all of these people, calling on the God who he has learned to trust and believe in, that fire will fall on this altar when everybody else could do nothing at all about it. Why? Not because it's some sort of trick that just proves that God is God. Did you notice the last bit of that verse? This, that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. This is God's plan to bring his people back to himself. This isn't God's anger. This isn't God's wrath. This is God's pathos. This is God's deep-seated need and felt requirement to be in relationship with his people. As Brian said earlier, that God couldn't live without us. He's prepared to die to get us back, as we've just taken bread and wine. And here is God reaching out to his people again, saying, look, I'm here. I can do anything. I'm the true God. Your life will only work if it's actually connected to me. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the soil, and also, for good measure, licked up the water in the trench. And when all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. You know what that is in Hebrew, don't you? Eli Yah, Eli Yah, Eli Jah, Eli Jah. Okay, Elijah, the man whose name means the Lord, he is God, had just brought the people to express the fact that they now believe that the Lord, he is God. He'd fulfilled his name, his vocation. Then Elijah commanded them, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away. They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. So that's the story. It's an incredible story. I'm sure you know it well. Myrtle said to me this morning, what on earth are you going to find to say? Everyone knows that so well. Well, I don't know, but we'll see as we go on. Just briefly, a few brief thoughts on the kind of what that story is all about. It happens right up here towards the Mediterranean coast. Some people say that might be where they had to run to get the water from, given that there was a drought in the land, right up around Mount Carmel, which is on the border of Jezreel. So what we're seeing here is this takes place right at the border between Israel, where Yahweh should be God, and Jezreel, where the other gods were God. It's on the border between two kingdoms, if you like. Which way will you lean, Israel? Which way will you turn, Israel? Who will you really trust, Israel, is what's going on. And they, of course, have given themselves to these idols. Idols are simply substitutes for God. They're parts of creation that we choose to put in the place of the Creator. In the Old Testament, it's lumps of wood or stone, but it could equally well be an ideology or a belief system. Things that we choose to put our faith in, which are part of creation and not the Creator himself. Why would you do that? Why would you choose, and remember, let me just say this as well, remember, this is written to Israel, this is written to God's people. This is a story about, in New Testament terms, the church. This isn't a kind of a condemnation or a challenge for the world, this is a challenge for those of us that consider ourselves to be God's people. The challenge of idolatry is not a challenge that the world is challenged about here, it's actually a challenge that God's people are challenged about. Who are you actually following? Who is actually king in your life? Who is actually calling the shots? Why would they turn to idols? Well, there are a range of reasons why they might have chosen to follow idols. An easy life. Jezebel might cut your head off if you didn't. So, you know, let's just go for an easy life. Let's just go with the flow. Let's just go with what everybody else is doing because it's safer, it's easier, you don't have to think too much. A lazy life. Everybody else is doing it. So why wouldn't we live that way? Why wouldn't we go with that particular flow? Everybody else is doing it. There's no need to stand out like a sore thumb. We'll just go with the flow. It's a blinkered life. It's not seeing how bankrupt that way of life actually is. When they were actually exposed here on Mount Carmel, it was proved there was nothing behind these idols. There was no one there. Nothing happened. No one answered. There was nothing there. It was a bankrupt, empty way of life. It had even issued in drought for 3 years, but they still couldn't see how empty the way of life that they were following actually was. But on the other hand, it was a hedonist lifestyle because particularly the Asherah goddess, offered all kinds of sexual favors for those who would actually worship her. In fact, sexual activity was part of the worship of Asherah. So it was, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why people might get sucked into other gods. Some of those might have a contemporary edge to them if we had time to kind of unpack that a little bit more. Going with the flow, the way things are, not wanting to stand out like a sore thumb, just wanting an easy life, not really thinking too deeply about the life that we get involved in. It's easy to get sucked into following idols. The root question is, who actually delivers? In this story, who actually delivers? Who actually can make a difference? That's the root question. So in this contest between Baal on one side and Yahweh on the other side, who actually can bring health? Who actually can create harvest and provision? Who actually can create happiness? Who really can give you hope for the future? And here on Mount Carmel, the promises of the false gods were exposed. They had nothing to offer. They couldn't even light a barbecue. They were completely impotent. And sometimes we can live in a world and not ask this question. This is the blinkered thing again. We can look at the way the world is around us and we can actually fail to spot how impotent it is to deliver any of these things. How the way the world is doesn't deliver happiness. It doesn't deliver great hope and so on. And that's what the idols do. They lie to you. They say, if you give yourself to us, we will deliver. But it's putting your faith in an illusion. When your career becomes your idol, it's an illusion. When your wealth becomes your idol, it's an illusion. In fact, the wealthier you get, possibly the less happy you get. Studies have been done into this all around the world. There's an interesting study done in East Germany. Remember, East Germany and West Germany used to be different countries. And they did a survey after the wall fell down and Germany's reunited of how happy East German people were. And they found that although they were then much more wealthy and had many more material goods because of their union with what was West Germany, they now felt much less happy. Because when they were in East Germany, they just compared themselves with other people in the Soviet bloc, and they were kind of pretty much the same as everybody else. When they were in East Germany, they compared themselves with people in West Germany, and even though they now had stuff, they didn't have as much stuff as them. And so this comparison thing starts, and gradually, in comparing themselves to other people, they found they were less and less happy. The gods lie to you. Getting more stuff doesn't make you more happy. In fact, they harm you. They're positively dangerous. Did you notice in the story how these people got more and more desperate, that actually they began to self-harm, to use some modern jargon, in order to try and get their gods to do what they wanted their gods to do? They were willing to damage themselves in order to get their gods to deliver what they expected their gods to do for them. We live in a sick society. The gods of our culture do not deliver. 1 in 10 children and young people aged between 5 and 16 have a diagnosable mental health disorder. That's about 3 children in every class in every school. There's been a big increase in the number of young people being admitted to hospital because of self-harm. Over the last 10 years, this figure has increased by 68% in 10 years. Nearly 80,000 children and young people suffer from severe depression. Severe depression, there's a spectrum. Severe depression, that number is. The number of young people aged 15 to 16 with depression nearly doubled between 1980 and 2000. In 2013, 6,233 suicides were registered in the UK, and the male suicide rate is now higher than it's ever been. We live in a sick society. Society is not delivering. Whether you're an adult or a kid or a young person, we live in a world where the gods are failing us. And we need some Elijahs to stand up and point it out. And we need a church that's willing not to go with the flow that those gods are taking us with. To actually live distinctively, to say the way of life that Yahweh gives us is the way to health and hope and harvest and happiness. And the other gods are failing us terribly as a culture and as a society. And we dare not take them into the heart of God's people. They harm you, they lie to you, and they exhaust you. You notice at the end of the story just what a bad state the prophets of Baal were in. Because they always want a little bit more. The gods have never got enough, small g, have never got enough. They always want more than you can actually deliver. So you get sucked into buying the slightly nicer whatever it is. And then you see your next door neighbor has got a slightly nicer version. So the gods say, well, look at that. You know, he's the person who's got the real career going on here. You know, call yourself a real career person. You've got a Ford Fiesta. You know, come on, there's nothing wrong with Ford Fiestas. Naughty people, judgmental people. Right, anyway, the gods never, they never give up on you. They exhaust you. I've got to work a bit harder, a bit more overtime, a bit more time. I've got to give a bit more, spend a bit more. They exhaust you. They're always asking for something that takes you just beyond your resources. And so there are three questions that define whether or not there are idols lurking around. Where is your source of health and happiness and hope and harvest, whatever that means for you, provision? I wonder if you say something like this ever to yourself. If only I could have, everything would be okay. That's an idol-defining question. If only I could have a bit more. I would be much happier today if loved me more. It's an idol-defining question. I know people have idolized their partners and their partners have walked out on them. And they can't cope with life because actually their security was not in God, but their security was in their partner. It's an idol-defining question. Idols can be people, not just stuff. I don't mean we put them on a pedestal and bow down and worship them. I just mean they become our source of happiness and hope and well-being. Or how about this? I just couldn't cope if I lost my job. Whatever. Now, of course, there's a kind of natural level of response to each of those questions, which is not wrong. But they are questions that probe just where our happiness and hope and health and well-being are rooted and registered. And sometimes, even as God's people, we become addicted to the way the world is, the gods that they're offered to us, career success, wealth, upwardly mobile, and all of that stuff. And we don't realize anymore that God is no longer Yahweh, but he's Yahweh plus, just as he was in ancient Israel. So how do we deal with that? How do we respond to what Elijah calls Israel to do, to come back to God, to come back to Yahweh? Well, the first thing, of course, is to see just how damaging these idols are and how empty they are. Until you've seen that, you won't want to do anything about them. But there's a man called Boniface. I like that name. Wouldn't it be great to be called Boniface? Dan's got a Boniface, has he? I don't think we should rename Dan. It's a very Boniface. Saint Boniface, 7th century missionary from Devon. He knew which way round to put the jam and the cream. He had a real heart for the Germanic-speaking people of the Rhineland. And they worshipped gods who they believed resided in oak trees. And so they had sacred oak trees around the Germanic tribal regions, which they used to worship. And St. Boniface concluded that if he wanted to bring these people from their idolatry and to expose the emptiness of their gods, that there were really no gods behind these things, even though they were giving themselves to them, the only way to do it was to take an axe to the tree and cut it down. So that's what he did. He took an axe to a sacred oak in a town called Gismar, where the sacred oak of the thunder god was located, and he hacked it down. It didn't make him popular, it must be said. It was the same as Elijah did at the end of the story. The prophets of Baal had to go. There was a kind of a ruthless element at the end of that story, I don't know if you noticed it, where it was they were too dangerous to leave around. The response to destroying idols is just that, to destroy them, to get out of the way. How do you do it? Firstly, if you're beginning to be convicted that maybe there's something in your life which has become the source of hope and happiness and well-being and health that isn't God, then talk to God about it. He loves you. He wants to know that you're beginning to wake up. He wants to know that you're beginning to be challenged by this thing. Talk to God. Pray about it. Even confess if you need to that actually you've got it wrong and you've been facing it in the wrong direction. Secondly, Elijah rebuilt the altar. The community of Israel was symbolically rebuilt by those 12 stones. Rebuild the altar of your Christian community. Where are your Christian friends? Who are the people who are going to talk some sense to you? Who are the people who are going to help you and support you as you begin to turn from the things that you've been giving your life to that maybe are not all they should be to you? Rebuild the altar of community. find some Christian friends and get immersed in a conversation with them about where things are going and where you want them to go. Thirdly, spend some time worshiping. What we do here on a Sunday morning is so important, because every week what it does is it builds into the rhythm of our lives a deliberate returning to the God, the true God, Yahweh. I know it's easy to find other things to do. I know our kids are busy. But this rhythm of life is so important. On the Lord's Day, to actually remind yourself who really is Lord, to come here, to sing these songs, to hear a scripture, to take bread and wine, to say, actually, no, okay, all the life, all week has been busy, I've been distracted, I've gone for this, I've gone for that. But this has reminded me where actually the true lordship rests in this world. This is who truly is king. Don't neglect worship. Fourthly, choose to be content. Nothing gets rid of idols quicker than choosing to be content. Because idols feed off dissatisfaction. Our culture feeds off of dissatisfaction. If you choose to be content, immediately the idols go running because they've got nothing to work on anymore. With what you've got, with who you've got, with the face that you look at in the mirror. Tough one. Choose to be content and thank God for what you have, who you are, and where you are. Choose to be content. It sends the idols packing. And fifthly, destroy any idol-building voices and habits. The things that reinforce those idols in your life, the things that actually you do, the things that you listen to, the people that you listen to, get off Facebook for a while. Stop watching whatever for a while. If the voices that are coming into your head are actually turning you away from complete and absolute trust in Yahweh, then be ruthless. Destroy them. Switch them off. Shut them. Get rid of them. Maybe just for a season. Remind yourself who really is God. So it's a great story. It's a powerful story. It's a world-changing story, because as I was saying last week, when Israel stops to be Israel, the light goes out in the world. And here's the moment where Israel had to choose. Will we turn back to Yahweh and allow his light to shine in us and through us, or will we keep going the direction we're going? Self-destructive, following these empty gods who have really nothing to offer. I'm going to invite the musicians to come back, and we're just going to respond for a minute or two to some of those thoughts. I ask you to bow your head for a moment where you're sat. Father, I thank you that you want us back. Whoever we are, wherever we've gone, whatever we've got into, however distracted we've become, whether accidentally or deliberately, you want us back. And this bread and wine in front of us that we've taken reminds us how powerfully you want us back. And I pray, Lord, that if anything has registered in any of our hearts this morning, if your word has come to us, then, Lord, I pray that you would cause it to grow, cause it to take root, cause us not to let it slip. And I pray, Father, that we would serve no other gods, that whether it's a person, whether it's an aspiration, whether it's an ideology, I pray, Lord, that you would deliver us. We want to say that we're going to lift our hands to you. We're going to lift our hearts to you. You're the true and the living God. The emptiness of the idols that serve our society and which we get seduced to follow has been exposed again. And we just pray, Father, you protect us from the empty and worthless ways that our culture teaches us to live. We want to come back and walk your way, to live your way, to worship you alone. And in so doing, receive the light of life that flows out of us into our community. Let's stand together and sing this song as a prayer, as a response. We move towards the close of the meeting. I lift my hands to the coming King.
I lift